the Gospel of John. The 19th chapter, beginning at the 17th verse. St. John 19, starting at verse 17. And he, bearing his cross, went out to a place called the place of skull, which is in Hebrew, Golgotha, where they crucified him and two others with him, one on either side, and Jesus in the center. Now Pilate wrote a title and put it on the cross, and the writing was, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of Jews. Amen.
I want to preach from the topic, when a cross became a throne. When a cross became a throne. Help me say that. When a cross became a throne. Thank you for traveling with us through the Gospel of John. We have discovered a few things about this gospel. First, we decided that the title, if we trace the book from beginning to end, the tenor of the message is moving us from religion to relationship. There are many people in the book who have religion, and they are tied and connected to ritual, but they do not have a relationship. They observe the law, but when the lawgiver comes down, they're really ready to kill him, which exposes the fact that they are, although they have religion and ritual, they are still in the darkness and have yet to come to the light. It is not enough to have, brothers and sisters, religion. It's not enough to come to church on Sunday morning. It is not enough to pay your offering, as much as that is appreciated. It is not enough to come to Bible study or to even have your own personal devotion. It's not even enough to keep a certain code of ethics, however good that code may be, for all that falls under the pale of religion. But you must have a relationship with the true and the living God. And the way that you have a relationship with him is by way none other than Jesus Christ. So we've tracked through the book, and we've seen that the book can be divided into two sections. We've seen chapters 1 through 12, which is called the Book of Signs. And within that section, there are at least no less than 7 signs that Jesus performs that authenticates who he is and what he's come to do. And then from chapters 13 to 20, you have what is called the Book of Glory. The Book of Glory emphasizes Jesus revealing himself as God, and the ultimate example of him being God and telling us what God is all about is actually in our text here. When he gets up on the cross, and if I be lifted up, I'll draw all men unto me. And when they lift him up on the cross, we see the essence of who God is. God is love. And at the end of the book, we get, John shows his hand and says, this is why I have written the book, chapter 20, verse 31. But these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life through his name. And everything that you read within the book has to be read and understood through those lenses. So as I look at the book, I see chapter 19, verse 17. This is where we begin this morning, and Jesus is being crucified. Matter of fact, let me just go ahead and read chapter 19, verse 17 to set the text here. They took Jesus, therefore, and went out bearing his own cross to the place called the place of the skull, which is called in Hebrew Golgotha. There they crucified him, and with him two other men, one on either side, and Jesus in between. I want to show this morning that John not only records the crucifixion of Jesus, but he records the crucifixion of Jesus and he wants us to see it from a specific or from a certain angle. You know, you've already seen the gospel. You've seen Jesus crucified in Matthew. You've seen Jesus crucified in Mark. You have seen Jesus crucified in Luke. And in every gospel, it's as if I come down now and she's sitting on this front row and I begin to take pictures of her. She's sitting there. I take a picture from the front. I take a picture from the side. I go to the back and I take a picture. I'm taking a picture of the same person sitting down doing the same action, but the difference is I'm taking it from different angles. Matthew records the same scene, but he records it from a certain angle. Mark, he takes a picture of Jesus on the cross, but from another angle. Luke does the same thing. And John takes a picture and encapsulates the cross and the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, but he takes it from a certain angle. And this angle is not so much the emphasis of suffering. Although suffering is there, the emphasis is not put on suffering. The emphasis is that although he's on the cross, he is reigning as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, even on the cross. I need to know that, and just when they say that he's king, it merely means that he is in control. He wants to emphasize this point. Last time I preached, and we were talking about Pilate and who was really on trial, even the court case between him and Pilate. Jesus turns the whole thing around where it's really not Jesus on trial and about what y'all gonna do with me. Pilate is really on trial because what he does with Jesus will determine his destiny. And now, even in chapter 19, as Jesus is on the cross, John communicates, he leaves certain things out, he adds certain things in order to emphasize this certain point, that although he's at his worst moment, yeah, he is still reigning, and the benefit that comes even from this type of situation. There is a scholar by the name of Ben Witherington. I came across one of the words that he brought up and it caught my attention. I'm going to bring it up to you. Actually, it was coined by Tolkien, the guy who wrote The Lord of the Rings. And this literary term that he coined, I thought was so fitting right here. The term is eucatastrophe. It's catastrophe with a EU on the front of it, a prefix. It's eucatastrophe. Matter of fact, won't you say it with me? Say eucatastrophe. Say it again. Say eucatastrophe. Yeah, it's one of those words. Matter of fact, I did a little research and I was looking because I got interested in the word itself to see how far the word went back. The word ain't got that much shelf life. Ain't been around that long. Tolkien hadn't been around. But Tolkien got this word, this eucatastrophe. I even looked at a few dictionaries. Didn't even see it, Sister Massey. In a few dictionaries, it didn't come up. The question mark. I'm writing and looking, Googling, and I didn't see it in just a few places. But this term, eucatastrophe, caught my attention. And when Tolkien wrote this and coined this term, what he meant was, when you're in the middle of a story, one of the things that happens is not only do you see catastrophe, but you see eucatastrophe. What does it mean? You means good and catastrophe means disaster. And when you put it together, the idea is a fortunate disaster. A eucatastrophe is a disaster, but it is a fortunate disaster. Now, you're like, huh? No, if it's a disaster, it's a disaster. You're like, how you gonna put good with disaster? That seems paradoxical. That seems like an oxymoron. It seems as though good and disaster don't go together. Yeah, but here in this text, what you have is a disaster. But because of what God is going to do with the disaster, it's a fortunate disaster. It's one of them things I hate it had to happen, but I'm glad that it did. If I was a gambling man, I bet that everybody in here that's been with God for any length of time has been through some kind of eucatastrophe. Yeah, it was a disaster. But when I look back over it, I'm glad that I hate it, but I'm glad I had to go through it because of what God used it to get. I never would have got to the place that I am now if it wouldn't have took place. It's a eucatastrophe. Yeah, the cross is a disaster. Matter of fact, it's the disaster of disasters. It don't get no worse than the Creator being crucified by his own creation. This is, by definition, the worst thing that has ever taken place in the course of human history. But in this disaster, Jesus takes the worst moment and intercepts it and uses it to bring the greatest blessing. I wish I had a witness in here. Everybody say, you catastrophe. It's a fortunate disaster. Yeah, I'm going to cry about it, but I'm going to shout it a minute because of what it's going to bring me. I wish I had a witness in here. You do know that at this cross, he does take death and uses death to bring life. You do know that he takes this curse and uses it to bring blessing. You do know that he takes this crucifixion and turns it into a sacrifice. You do know that, don't you? He takes the worst disaster that has ever taken place in the course of human history and uses it to bring the greatest blessing. I wish I had a witness in here. Come on, say it one more time. Say, you catastrophe. Oh yeah, it's a fortunate disaster. Now, as I look at this thing, I'm seeing that he's reigning on the cross. And here is the thing, y'all, because you can like, okay, yeah, he's reigning, he's on the cross, this happened 2,000 years ago. What in the world does this have to do with me? It has so much to do with you. You have to learn, I have to learn how to make a connection, hear this now, between his cross and my crisis. Let me say that again. I need to understand. I need to make, there is a deep connection between his cross and my crisis. And here's the connection, y'all, that I'm going to argue through this text. Here it is, because it's not just to give us a history lesson that one day, 2,000 years ago, this man died on the cross. No, the question is, how does this benefit me? And here it is, y'all. If he can reign and rule and be in control of his cross, then he can be in control in the worst of your crisis. I'm going to say that one more time, because somebody missed it. I ain't going to say too much this morning. But if he can be in control of the worst of his cross, then he can be in control of the worst of your crisis. Come on in this text and travel with me and see if I'm lying. Verse 17 and verse 18. What I see, first of all, is that he is in control, first of all, of his identity. He is in control of his identity. At the worst moment, when it can't get no worse, he's in control of his identity. Now, the reason why I bring this up, look at verse 19. Pilate also wrote an inscription and put it on the cross. It was written, Jesus the Nazarene, the King of the Jews. Therefore, many of the Jews read this inscription, for the place where Jesus was crucified was near the city. And it was written, look, it was written. It was written in Hebrew, it was written in Latin, and it was written in Greek. It was written in Hebrew, the Judean language. It was written in Latin, yeah, the political language. And it was written in Greek, the common language, so everybody in the known world could read it. Verse 21, so the chief priests of the Jews were saying to Pilate, do not write the King of the Jews, but rather that he said, I am the King of the Jews. Y'all see this here? There's a little thing going on here. And then at the end, verse 22, Pilate answered and said, what I have written, I have written. The first thing I want you to see is that he is in control of his identity. Now, on the cross, back then, it was nothing unusual to put what they called a title or a titulus over the cross. Every time you would have somebody on a cross, you would put over the cross a title based on the reason why the person is dying. All right. So what Pilate decided to do was put on the top of there, King of the Jews, Jesus Nazarene, King of the Jews. Now, when he does this, the thing to do, see, a crucifixion was not just to kill you. I mean, there was a whole lot of ways to kill you. We can make you drink poison. We can throw you off a cliff. We can stone you. We can strangle you. It's a whole lot. I mean, when you start talking about killing somebody, you can get real creative. So, yeah, I mean, this thing's just about killing. The goal of a crucifixion is not only to kill you, but also to humiliate you. That is, we're going to put you out in public and expose you, and whatever honor and whatever dignity and whatever you did have, we're going to strip everything away from you. And you would think that that would happen here, because Jesus is on this cross and he's looking and dying as a curse. And you would think that they're stripping him of everything that he's worth. But on the cross, over the cross, you have this title called King of the Jews. And the Jews didn't like this. Let me tell you why the Jews didn't like that. Because it's really preaching to them who he really is. Now, Pilate meant it for a joke. the Jews saw it as an insult, but in reality, this is really who he was. He was Jesus, King of the Jews, in the worst moment in human history. You can put me on the cross, you can tie me up, you can nail me, but at the end of the day, you have not taken my identity. I'm still who I am. I'm King. Raining on the cross. They didn't mean to communicate that, but behind the providential scene, God is preaching to them, you can do whatever you want, but at the end of the day, he has not lost his identity. He's still who he says he is. I wish I had a witness in here. The point would be this sign is actually preaching that when you put Jesus in the worst of circumstances, he's still in control. When you put Jesus in the worst of circumstances, it doesn't change who he is, but rather he'll use the worst of circumstances to expose and confirm who he is. I hope you heard what I just said. When you put Jesus in the worst of circumstances, it doesn't change who he is, but rather he uses that situation to expose and confirm who he is. We know that because we do have a tendency to define Jesus and identify God based on our circumstances. When he's put us up and gave us wonderful stuff and blessing you like you want to and you're happy and smiling, oh, he's wonderful. He's counselor. He's mighty God. Oh, you know. But the moment I put him, he puts me in this situation that's uncomfortable. The moment he puts me in the crucible and the vice grip of light, all of a sudden, well, I thought he was this, and I knew I thought I could trust him, and I don't know where he is. Here he is. He's saying, look, don't allow those circumstances to identify and identify who he is, because he's still God in the worst of circumstances. Oh, yeah, we do have a tendency to try to define God and strip him of who he is based on our circumstances. You have guys like pastoral theologians who are so sympathetic to our problems that in trying to explain to their congregations who God is in the midst of their trouble, they strip God of who he is. You have, for instance, some people who try to strip him of his omnipotence, that he's all powerful. There's a book entitled, you probably heard it, Why Bad Things Happen to Good People. Yeah, that is a wrong title. The mystery is why good things happen to bad, low down, dirty folk. That's the real question. But anyway, he's a rabbi and he's preaching, and he's trying to, his daughter has died, and he's trying to make sense of who God is. And one of the ways that he tries to make sense of God is he strips God of his omnipotence. He said, yeah, God cares about you, but when my daughter died, what God did, God was just a mourner like the rest of us. And when I came to the funeral, God came there and he put his arm around me and he just mourned with the family because he had done all he could do. He really couldn't do no more. So he said, yeah, we got a God who can care, but we don't have a God who's in control. Now, then there are other people who say when they get in trouble, not only do we try to rip him and rob him of his omnipotence, but we try to rip him and rob him of his omniscience. That is, well, maybe he's in control or whatnot, and maybe he cares, but the reason why God allowed this to happen is because he just didn't know. There is a doctrine out now called open theism. Open theism says that God is ignorant of the future. He didn't see it coming. He's just as ignorant as you was. You sitting talking about, how did this happen? And he turned around, look at you. I don't know. I didn't see it coming either. I can't serve that kind of God. I need somebody who can see it well. I wish I had a witness in here. Yeah, so we say, well, he didn't know. He didn't know. Then there are others who will strip him not only of his omnipotence, there are others who strip him of his omniscience. But then another way is the atheists try to strip him of his omnipresence and say, well, it's not that he don't care. It's not that he's in control. The issue is he ain't even there. He don't even exist. And here's the thing. No, but the text tells me this, that you don't define him based on what happens to you. Because in the worst of circumstances, he will drop in the worst of circumstances, and it doesn't change who he is. He uses that situation. I wish I had a witness in here to confirm and expose who he is. That gives me hope, because I don't just need to know that he's in control of good times. Matter of fact, I don't need to know that he's just in control of my health. I need to know that he's in control of my sickness. I don't just need to know that he's in control, yeah, of my bankroll. I need him to know that he's in control of my bankruptcy. I need to know that he's in control not only when my marriage is going well. I need to know that he's in control when all hell breaks loose. I don't need to know that he's in control when I walk down the aisle and get married. I need to know he's in control when the person I've been with for years turn around and say, baby, I don't want you no more. I need to know not only is he in control when I get the promotion, but I need to know he's in control when I get the termination. I need to know that he's in control of the worst circumstances. And in this text, he said, yeah, Sean. Yeah, Sean, let me tell you how much I'm in control. I drop down to the worst of circumstances. Don't just look at the nails in the hand. Don't just look at the blood. Don't just look at the crown of thorns. Don't just look at the pierced side. But look over the cross. And over the cross, you will see a sign that tell you who I am. King of the Jews, I'm still in control. He's in control of his identity. Not only is he in control of his identity, brothers and sisters, but he's also in control of his destiny. Look at the text in verse 23. Then the soldiers, when they had crucified Jesus, they took his outer garments and made four parts, a part to every soldier, and also the tunic. Now the tunic was seamless, woven in one piece. So they said to one another, let us not tear it, but cast lots for it to decide who it shall be. Look at the rest of it, though. It said, this was to, what your text say, fulfill the scripture. They divided my outer garments among them, and for my clothing, they cast lots. Now, it's really not too much of a surprise that these brothers are here gambling over the cup. And just by the way, the whole point, John is trying to make the point here. This is not the place where you go and say that, see, that's why it's wrong to go down to the casino and gamble. Now, there are other ways to say that you don't need to go to the casino and gamble, but you don't go here. See, they're gambling for Jesus' clothes, so don't go down to the casino. Ain't no connection. John's point here ain't Jesus died and don't go to the casino. The point. The point he's trying to make here when he says that they're gambling for his thing. See, here's the thing. First of all, it's not really news that they're gambling for his stuff, because this is one of the things that actually happened. Actually, when they would take the clothes of somebody who was crucified, it was to them what a gratuity or a tip was to a waiter or something. It's just assumed that you're going to get it. It becomes an extra gift on top of your regular pay. All right. So this was nothing unusual for them to gamble for anybody's clothes. Now, notice the text talks about his humiliation. Look, he loses everything that he has. Notice here, he loses everything that he has. First of all, he loses the outer garment, and they divide that stuff. But then not only does he lose the outer garment, but he loses also his underwear. All right? They wouldn't call it that now. Your text is going to clean it up and say undergarment, but I mean, it wasn't nobody wearing no Hanes, but you had an undergarment, and it was draws. He lost his draw. I mean, we don't like, we create these pretty pictures of him and all that. But forget the picture. What the text is saying is they gambled for his outer garment, and they gambled for his draw, and they took his outer garment. Matter of fact, when it was normal for people to actually get crucified naked. So the goal was not just to kill you. The goal was to humiliate you. So they're here, and they've taken everything that he has. And they're gambling for his stuff. They divided it in lots. They gambled for his seamless garment. And now, that's not really the point. The point is this. Notice, the surprise is this. They did it to fulfill the scripture. Do y'all see that? So at the point where Jesus has lost everything that he has, What's going on is, he said, no, he's still in control. And how do I know he's in control at the point where he lost everything that he had? Because the text said that this was already coming. We already saw this coming. It said that this came to fulfill the scripture. This ain't nothing that came by surprise. Over 1,000 years ago, this scripture was already prophesied. God gave it in Psalm 22 that they cast in lots. It was already prophesied that this is going to happen and this is the way it's going to happen. He lets me know that God is in control even in this circumstance. And see, what better way to show that you're in control than to sit your enemy down and show him exactly how you're going to whoop him? Let me show you. See what happens is, you got Psalm 22, you have Psalm 23, and you have Psalm 24. Usually we read Psalm 23 and that's all. But Psalm 22, Psalm 23, and Psalm 24 are three psalms that are connected together. They are what's called the shepherd psalm. Psalm 22 is dealing with the good shepherd who lays his life down for the sheep. Psalm 23 is the great shepherd who takes care of his flock, who leads me and guides me. I wish I had a witness by still waters. And then Psalm 24 is the chief shepherd who reigns and rules over the affairs of life. That's where it says that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. So you have the good shepherd who dies in Psalm 22. You have the great shepherd who takes care of his flock in 23. And you got the chief shepherd in Psalm 24 who's reigning and ruling. And what he does here is, he said, look, y'all, it looks real bad. Let me tell you what's going on with Jesus right now. Let's rewind. The same thing that happened to David is happening to Jesus. But see, look here. This is what's happening. We just in Psalm 22. So what he does is, he's saying, look, so if he's going through this stuff in Psalm 22 as the good shepherd who dies, then you also got to be the great shepherd. I wish I had a witness of Psalm 23 who's going to take care of his flock. And if he's going to be the great shepherd of Psalm 23 and the good shepherd who dies in Psalm 22, he also got to be the chief shepherd who gets up and says, who is the King of glory? The King of glory is the Lord. So the Psalm of 22 where he dies, I wish I had a witness in here. You got to have the Psalm 22 that he dies that anticipates the Psalm 24 where he gets up and reigns and rules. In essence, it's like this. You've seen this stuff before. It's not enough that we get excited that our person, our hero wins, but the way he wins excites us. See, what makes the chills go down your spine is that the person who wins not only wins, but tell you how he's gonna win. You see this all over. There's a movie I used to like, Arnold Schwarzenegger in True Lies. Ooh, I love that movie. If you ain't seen it, go ahead and rent it. But look here. When you look at that movie, one of the best parts of the movie is when he is at his lowest. He is at his most vulnerable moment. They have given him some drugs. He's out of it. He's talking all out of his head, and they're about to kill him and his wife. Now, we know he's going to get out of it. I mean, this is Arnold Schwarzenegger. He gonna get out of it. But the reason why we like it is because he tell us how he gonna do it. He looks at his enemy at his weakest moment. He looks his enemy in the face and say, I'm about to whoop you, and let me tell you how I'm gonna do it. First of all, I'm gonna take that knife and I'm gonna twist your head like a chicken. And then I'm going to use your body, yeah, as a shield. And then I'm going to shoot that guy, and I'm going to run on out of here. The guy came over and said, how you going to do that? And he snapped his neck, used him as a shield, and walked up out of there. What made it so great was not that he just won, but he called it before it happened. Oh, that's why we like Babe Ruth. We don't like Babe Ruth just because he won, but the reason why we like Babe Ruth was, before he hit the ball, he would point the bat at where he going to hit the ball, because he called it before it happened. Oh yeah, that's why we like the pool player, the one we know you gonna win, but we just say, a ball, corner pocket, you told me how you gonna do it. Yeah, I wish I had a witness in there. That's why somebody's crazy about Muhammad Ali, because we knew he was gonna win. Fly like a butterfly, sting like a bee. We knew he was gonna win, but yeah, he said, in the second round, I'ma knock you out. He called it before it happened. And here in this text, Jesus said, look here, they got me on the cross, but I called it before it happened. See, you know, some of us got a messed up theology. Here it is. When you moan, the devil don't know what you're talking about.
Jesus said, hold up now. Jesus said, that may be how you roll, but that ain't how I roll. I ain't got to sit around and sneak around and whisper and give codes as if say no about it, he's going to thwart my plan. That ain't how Jesus do. He said, no, what we going to do is, what I did was I sat Satan down. And I said, now I'm going to whoop you. But let me tell you how I'm going to whoop you. In Psalm 22, you're going to take my garments and kill me. But in Psalm 23, I'm going to be the great shepherd. And it's going to be prepared table before me in the presence of my enemies. And by the time I get to Psalm 24, lift up your heads, all ye gates, and be ye lifted up, ye everlasting doors, and the King of glory shall come in. Well, who is this King of glory? The one who died in Psalm 22, the one who got up in Psalm 24, 3, and the one who reigns in Psalm 24. He called it. You ain't got to worry about your situation. Whatever happens in your life, as a child of God, you know you're going to come out. But before eternity, God had already spoken what was going to happen in your life. And just as sure as he planned for the tragedy, he planned for the triumph. Just as sure as he planned for the suffering, he planned for the resurrection. He's not only in control of his identity, he's also in control of his destiny. And not only is he in control of his destiny, but he's also in control of his duty. Y'all think I'm lying? Look at this text. Look at verse 25. Then he switches from his spiritual duties, so to speak, to take care of his domestic duties. He's sitting up here dying and dealing with a spiritual issue. But he doesn't allow his spiritual issues to get in the way of his human physical responsibilities. What I'm saying is, he's taking care of the world. But as he's taking care of the world, he also stopped to take care of his mama. Let me say it again. He's taking care of his spiritual duties. But in the midst of taking care of the spiritual duties, saving the world, he takes time to take care of his mama. Now, that ought to speak volumes to you right there. That I'll let you know that however spiritual you get, I wish I had a witness in here. You know, you are not, see, be so spiritual and see, be so up there that I'm doing stuff for God and I'm out crusading, I'm out ministering, and you don't minister to your family. Y'all do see this, don't you? He's on the cross doing the spiritual work, but he doesn't let that get in the way of taking care of his family. A lot of times we get twisted and we'll use the ministry and we'll use God's stuff as an excuse to neglect our family. But I wish y'all act like I ain't getting this from nowhere. Yeah, but see, don't allow your spiritual to do it. See, a lot of times we get so spiritual all up in the air and you up there praying. Can I just play with you for a little while? As it relates to a husband or a preacher, I'm sitting up here evangelizing, going throughout the whole world. I can't allow that and never spend time with my children and tell them about Jesus. I wish I had a witness in here. As a woman, you sitting up there, and here you are, oh, I'm praying, and oh, I'm in ministry and all that, but my husband is at home hungry because he ain't got no meal because you up at the church or you down at the mission and you ain't took care of your... Well, won't you just throw something into the microwave? I'm doing the Lord's business. Hold up. The Lord's business is your home. Jesus takes care of the Lord's business while he's on the cross. But at the same time, he takes care of family. He takes care of his mama. You can't be nothing to the world if you ain't nothing at home. It becomes a hard thing. I'm preaching to myself. It's balance, man. It's a balance. And you're going to get hit everywhere you get, but you just got to keep on trying. I wish I had a witness up in here. Yeah, I cannot justify giving all my time up here. And my wife never get into my time. My wife never sees me. And the reason why she don't never see me is because I'm always up counseling with you and talking about with your family and your husband and your wife and your kids. I got some too. I better take care of them. I'm going to be sitting up crying with you. I ain't got none either. That's why I went to Destin, and I ain't apologizing. And I'm going to go again. I'm going to spend some time with that woman. He was on the cross, but he took care of the family. But there's a greater picture than this, brother. There's a deeper picture in here. When I see that he takes care of his mother, notice the way that he takes care of his mother in verse 20, 25. Verse 26, when Jesus then saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." Then he said to the disciple, he says, "Behold your mother." From that hour, the disciple took her into his own household. The greater point here is that what's here is, see, Mary does not get her dignity ultimately because she is the mother of Jesus. And let me tell you what's really going on here is this. Actually, notice that Jesus gives his mother over not to his family, not to his blood brothers, but he gives gives his mother over to a disciple, to somebody that is in his family. Jesus has created his own family. Matter of fact, you already know who is my brother? Who is my brother but he that doeth the will of my Father? Jesus has created his own family, and now what he does is he doesn't bring her to the blood. You say blood is thicker than water, and that's true, but spirit is thicker than blood. There is a bind there between believers. They may not even be there between blood brothers and sisters. And what Jesus does is he brings his mother. Listen to this, y'all. He brings his mother into his family. Do y'all see that here? Which means this, that Mary does not get dignity because Jesus is in her family. Ultimately, she has dignity because she is in Jesus' family. Here at the cross, Jesus adopts his mother into his family. Now, that ought to deal with some of this Catholic stuff out here. Talking about, oh, pray to Mary, and Mary is the mediatrix. And when you pray, you pray. If you want to get a prayer to Jesus, you need to pray to Mary. That's a bunch of mess. You better not pray to Mary because Mary hollering back down at you. You better pray to Jesus because I needed him just as bad as you did. Her significance is not that she's Jesus' mother. Her significance is that Jesus is her Lord. He's in control of his duties. He's in control of his destiny. He's in control of his identity. Finally, he's in control of his death. The text says in verse 28, he says, "I am thirsty." He who is full becomes empty, that we might become full. Look at that. I am thirsty. Out of all the things, y'all, that Jesus could have said, it baffles me that he says, "I am thirsty." I mean, if it's anything that he shouldn't have lacked, since the bowl where it should have been water. I mean, because all through the gospel, he's been dealing with water. If it's anything that he shouldn't have run out of, it should have been water. He said, "I am." You know, the one, he says, "I'm thirsty." He gets thirsty. The one who in chapter 2 turns water into wine is talking about, "I'm thirsty." The one in chapter 3 who tells Nicodemus, "You must be born again, born of the water and of the spirit," is thirsty. The one in chapter 4 who told the woman at Samaria at the well that if you drink of me, I'm living water, he is thirsty. The one in chapter 6 who walks on the water is now thirsty. The one in chapter 7 who calls out in the celebration and say, "Everyone who is thirsty, come and drink of me, and out of your bellies will flow rivers of living water." He is thirsty. Here's my question. How can water get thirsty? And the answer is that he who was full became empty that he might fill us up. I wish I had a witness here. The reason why you can be filled today with the Spirit, the reason why you can be filled today with God, is because he became temporarily empty that you might become eternally full. I'm thirsty. He's even in control. Y'all go pre with before just 1 minute. Not only do I see that he's thirsty, but he also cries out one more thing. He says, "It is finished." Now, When he says it's finished and I'm finished, after I tell you that he's finished. Y'all with me here? Here he shows that he's in control even of his death. That's the thing that you would expect that no one's in control of. But here at this point of death, he's even in control. Now, as I close, I want you to notice that he's in control of two aspects of his death. First of all, he's in control of the spiritual aspect of his death. But he's also in control of the physical aspect of his death. When he says, it is finished. The term in the English is three words. It is finished. In Greek, it's one word, tetelestai. And it just doesn't mean it's completed. The term means it's paid in full. Matter of fact, it's tetelestai. Matter of fact, y'all say it with me so I won't feel like I'm strange. Say tetelestai. Yeah. Look at somebody say tetelestai. Look at somebody else say tetelestai. Say it means paid in full. Back then, when you owed a bill, you had taxes due, or you had some kind of bill due. When you paid the bill in full, the person would put, the Levite or whoever you gave the money to, would step and write on the paper, tetelestai, paid in full. What Jesus is saying here, that this is not just a crucifixion, this is a sacrifice. I wish I would have had a witness in here. I'm not just dying as some political revolutionary. I'm dying for the penalty of sin. And you know what? Yes, what is he paying? What is it that has to be paid in full that he's dying for? Well, you do remember that your greatest problem was your sin. Here, look, y'all, at his darkest hour, he deals with your deepest problem. Let me say that again. At his darkest hour, he deals with your deepest problem. Now, you do know your deepest problem is not your bills. You know your deepest problem is not that husband or that wife you want to get rid of. You know your deepest problem is not that boss that's getting on your nerve. You know that. You know your deepest problem is not that coworker. Your deepest problem is not that upgrade you want on your house or your car. Your deepest problem is your sin problem. Now, all of us come in. Bible say all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. My sin may not be your sin. I wish I had a witness, but all of us got some. And I don't know what it is, but all of us got some sin and we run up an account. I wish I had a witness in here. I don't know. Your sin might be like Nicodemus. You're self-righteous. You're coming to church and you think you got it all together, but you got a pride problem. I don't know. Your sin might be like the woman at the well. You're running around with everybody. You can't settle down. I don't know. Your problem may be like the man in chapter 5. And when Jesus put him on his back and he couldn't get healed, when he finally got healed, he's still acting a fool. Some of your problem might be that. God has put you back up against the wall, try to teach you a lesson. As soon as he relieves you, you still go back to the same old mess. I don't know. That might be your problem. Your problem might be like the one in chapter 6 who you don't want. You ain't crazy about God. You crazy about what you can get out of him. You know, 5,000, he freed the bread. You just want the fish and the loaves of bread. You want a fish dinner. You don't want a relationship. Maybe that's your sin. Maybe your sin is like the woman in chapter 8 who's caught in the act of adultery. Maybe you just on Front Street, your stuff then got exposed. Or you might be like the man that they never found and, you know, sitting up and hiding, talking about, yeah, you had a thing to do with it, but we ain't caught you yet. I don't know what your sin is. But at the cross, he took all of that. I wish I had a witness in here. All the burnt offerings and all the sin offerings and all the guilt offerings was not enough to pay for the sin. That was just a credit. That was just a credit payment. I wish I had. Yeah. You know we said, I can't pay all of it, but I'll put something on it. Yeah, when you went to the sacrifice, you were just putting something on it. But after a while, somebody got to come along and pay the bill. Jesus got up on the cross and took your sin, your lying, your thieving, your pride. He took all of it and said, tetelestai, paid in full. And since I paid it, it's been forgiven and nobody can reinstate the debt. He deals with your deepest problem in his darkest hour. If he can be in control of his cross, how much more can he be in control of your crisis? But not only finally, y'all, I see, not only is he over in control of the spiritual part of the death, but finally he's in control of the physical aspect of the death.
You keep on reading there. The text said that they didn't break his legs. Now you like, so what? They didn't break his leg. Well, they busted him up. They beat him. They done did everything else to him. They spit on him. You talking about they didn't break his legs. Big deal. What's the big deal that they didn't break his legs? I'm glad that you asked why they didn't break his leg. The text stops to tell you that they did not break his legs. In order to appreciate that, you must understand something of the way they crucified folk back there. During the time when they would crucify you, this is one of the most intense kind of sufferings that you ever go through. The cross was invented by the Persians, perfected by the Romans to inflict the greatest amount of pain over the longest amount of time. Anybody know about the cross in here? So as he's on the cross, what would happen is this. The way you would die, it wasn't just because the nails was in you and all that. But what would happen after you on there for so long, your body would begin to slump down. And when your body slumped down, your chest cavity would cave in and you couldn't breathe in and you couldn't breathe out. So what you would do in order to prolong your life is you would push up with your legs so that you can breathe a little bit and open up your chest cavity. And then you go back down and do it again. And when you begin to suffocate, you push up with your legs. After a while, the Roman soldier would say, okay, it's leg breaking time. And when they would break the leg, they would break your legs. So when you would go down again and you would breathe and you couldn't suffocate, you couldn't breathe, you would push up with your leg, but your leg was broke now and you couldn't get back up, and because you couldn't back up, you would suffocate. I wish I had a witness in here. So we gonna break your leg so you can't get up and you can't breathe. So what happens is, y'all, they go to the first guy on the other side of the cross. They break his legs. He goes down for the last time. He can't breathe. He tries to get up. The legs are broke. He dies. Go to the next guy on the other side. They break his legs. He goes down for the count. He can't breathe. He tries to get up, but his legs are broke. He dies of suffocation. Oh, but when they get to Jesus, they don't break his legs. And the reason why they don't break his legs is because by the time they get to him, he's already dead, which means they didn't take his life. He gave his life because he's in control of his identity. He's in control of his destiny. He's in control of his duty, and doggone it, he's in control of his death. But because he was in control of his death, he was also in control of his resurrection. If you keep on reading in chapter 20, the story doesn't end with him dying on the cross. But early Sunday morning, I wish I had a witness in here, he got up with all power in his hand. They want to argue. Matter of fact, if you look at the text, it just said that there was an empty tomb. And now, instead of just shouting about the fact that he got up, we so smart, we want to fight over which tomb he got up in. I went over there, and the point wasn't that he got up. Everybody just sitting over here. Well, that ain't the tomb. The tomb is over here. So I went to the first. I said, okay, take me to the first place. Well, see, this is where he was. He was in the Holy Roman Sepulchre. This is the tomb. They said, no, somebody said, no, that ain't the tomb. Come over. Okay, I went over here. I went to the other place. They said, this is really where he died. Look at the thing, and here's the reasons why. And I asked the question. I said, hey, which tomb was he in? But here's the answer to the question. I done been to both of them, and guess what? He ain't in nan one of them, because he got up with all power, in control of his identity, in control of his destiny, in control of his duty, in control of his death, in control of his resurrection and his deliverance. If he can be in control of his cross, then he can be in control of your crisis. If he was able to reign and rule in his worst moment, how much more, as the resurrected and exalted Christ, can he reign and rule over your ear? What is it that you're crying about? What is you taking these sleeping pills? You can't go to sleep. Got you all great. What is it got you all? You're going to pull your hair out and wear it about? What is it? Because if he can reign and rule over this kind of thing, then just maybe he has the power to bring something wonderful out of your life. And all God's people stand. Come on, stand. Let's stand. Doors of the church are open. There's nothing better than knowing Jesus. Somebody know that he'll pick you up and turn you around. He'll change your life. no matter how bad things get, don't get this bad. He went to the worst of situations and got in control of that to preach to you that he has control over your situation. Not only was he in control of the worst situation, but in his darkest hour, he dealt with your deepest problem. Your deepest problem is not some financial issue. Your deepest problem is not who's going to be the president. Your deepest problem is not a recession. Your deepest problem is your sin. And he's dealt with that at his darkest hour.